There were two stories that seemed to dominate the news yesterday. We weren't live yesterday. We had a replay of our interview with Kip and Max from the Kip and Max Save the World podcast. Hope you enjoyed that if you tuned in. Great guys, great podcast. You should check it out. I was busy doing family stuff, as I'm wont to do on occasion. The two stories from yesterday that seemed to dominate the news, one was, of course, the deal struck, if you can call it that, with North Korea between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. And the other was a raccoon scaling a skyscraper in St. Paul. Bet you can guess which one we're about to talk about.
Or maybe the wrong one.
According to Brad, the wrong one. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. You can catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app, and our channel will pop right up. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening, and I'm going to ask you to do so because I need you to tell me. We're going to reverse the roles here tonight. I'm going to be the audience, and you are going to be the bellicose opinion mongers. You're going to tell me what to think about this deal with North Korea, because I genuinely don't know what to think about it. I can't make heads or tails of what's happening right now, why it's happening, and where it's all going. 651-989-5855. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show.
I can already predict a few of the talking points. First, we have to give him credit because it's the first time American president has ever met with the North Korean leader. Two, Trump is playing 4D chess and he's smarter than anyone we know because he was able to get this deal done. And third is he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize because he's done more for world peace than Obama ever has. Obama only started wars, but Trump is trying to end them because did you know that the Korean War is still going on for 50 years? It's only an armistice, not an officially a peace deal.
I could tell. Brad really wanted to talk about the raccoon.
I did.
He really, really, really wanted
to
talk about the raccoon.
I'm already planning my Halloween costume to be the NPR raccoon.
Nice. So are you going to be the whole, like, you should go as the tower with the raccoon on you? Or are you going to be the raccoon?
No, I'm going to dress up as a raccoon and then just put an NPR t-shirt on.
Oh, that's excellent. That's actually
it's,
really
it's
good.
It's simple
idea.
But effective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully this remains something that's part of the local consciousness in October. We'll see.
And people will get it.
All right. So here are my questions looking at this thing, because I don't think you're off, Brad, in terms of anticipating what some of the talking points on the North Korean deal may be. Now, just to address, you know, those first two. You know, setting aside the Nobel Peace Prize campaign that may or may not be moving forward for President Donald Trump. The idea that this is an achievement because it's the first time that a U.S. president has sat down with the leader of North Korea. Is that an achievement? Because here's the thing. As I understand, and maybe I'm wrong. Look, I'm not coming at this with any sort of agenda tonight, genuinely, sincerely. I seek only understanding in this scenario. Is it an achievement in the sense that no other president was able to do it? Because it occurs to me that the reason no previous president has met with Kim Jong-un or any of his successor or predecessors is because they intentionally did not want to meet with them. Like, the policy was you don't legitimize this dictator by putting him on an equal standing on the world stage and make it look like, you know, he's at the same level as the president of the United States. Like, that was the policy. So to say it's an achievement seems to sidestep the reason why no previous president, because it's not as though Kim Jong-un wouldn't have sat down with Obama if Obama had sincerely tried to do it Or maybe that is what we believe. I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence.
I don't think Obama was gutsy enough to do it.
Well, and there you go. Now, that you can make that case. You can absolutely make the case that it's a bold move. It's a gutsy move. You know, this is something that defies convention. It's very Trumpian in that nature, and I will grant you that. Absolutely. And I'm also, with this 4D chess argument, I don't believe, I'm not one of these people who subscribes to the 4D chess version of interpreting Trump's words and deeds. And the reason why is because it's for the exact same reason that I tend not to subscribe to conspiracy theories. The reason I don't subscribe to conspiracy theories is because in order to buy into them, you have to accept as a given things that you do not know. A conspiracy theory is built upon layers of assumptions. And the same thing is true to try to buy into these 4D chess theories that people construct as to why Trump did X or why Trump said Y. He's really doing it because of this reason on top of that reason on top of this reason. None of which, you know, all of which is like causal. Like it has to be in that order of operation for it to make sense. And you can't take any one of the pieces for granted. So I don't buy into the 4D chess thing. That said, I am open to the very real possibility that there is a strategy here that is not obvious. That as the master negotiator that Trump portrays himself to be and that a lot of people regard him as, that in fact, he may be getting the world to look in one direction while he's really doing something else over here where nobody's looking that's going to be beneficial to the United States going forward. But if he's doing that, if that's his deal, then he's really good at it because I can't see where the other hand is. I can't see what the trick is, what it is that he's trying to pull off here. Let's talk to Ken in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, good evening. I hope you can hear me all right. I'm in a desktop for my phone. But Donald Trump, I think, did this because he truly does love America and he doesn't want us to be at war. I honestly think that he really did step up to miss right, instead of what everybody else would try to.
No, looks like those technical difficulties finally caught up with us.
Talk. You there? Hello?
Yeah. See if you can keep going. We'll give you another shot here. Your phone was breaking up.
Yeah. Hang on. I'll call you right back.
All right. Sounds good, Ken. Well, there you go. I got the general sense of what Ken was talking about, that there's a sincere desire on Trump's part to do what's right for the country and to prevent war. And I accept that. I think that, I mean, the alternative is to believe the opposite, right? That Trump wants there to be a war, that Trump wants what's bad for the country. And you know, to believe that, you have to be a little bit delusional. And I know there are folks on the left, folks in the Democratic Party who absolutely believe that, who absolutely believe that there's malevolence driving the White House's agenda here. I don't think that's correct. At all, obviously. Of course, I would have said the same thing about any other president as well. You know, too often we subscribe malevolent intent to the actions that the people on the opposite side of the political aisle take. No American citizen wants the destruction that comes with a war and takes the actions that they take based upon a sincere belief that they're going to prevent it. So we could certainly grant that to Trump. All right, so there's a couple of pieces here that they come from, you know, one comes from Vice News, which is generally a left-leaning news organization. Sorry to be redundant, but even more so than usual. And the other comes from Bloomberg. And both of these portray what took place yesterday with a critical eye, from a critical perspective. And I think it's necessary to take a look at these developments from that critical perspective because it sets the stage for the questions that I want to ask. So from Vice News, Donald Trump said Tuesday he will end the inappropriate and provocative war games jointly held with South Korea, a concession to Pyongyang for which the dealmaker appeared to receive nothing in return. The gift to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was revealed after the leaders signed a declaration committing both countries to working toward denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Trump framed the freezing of the military exercises as a cost-saving effort, but the war games have long been a major concern for North Korea. The end of the exercises in South Korea was not part of the official declaration, but Trump announced his intention in a lengthy press conference after Kim had already boarded his flight back to Pyongyang. The war games are very expensive, and it's a very provocative situation, Trump said. So under the circumstances that we're negotiating, I think it's inappropriate to be having war games. When asked about bringing home the almost 30,000 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea, Trump said, I'd like to bring them home, but that's not part of the equation right now, but we will be stopping the war games. Trump then described in detail how the U.S. has to fly bombers from its base in Guam 6.5 hours away. That's a long time for these big, massive planes to be flying to South Korea to practice and drop bombs all over the place and then go back to Guam, Trump said, adding, I know a lot about airplanes, and it's very expensive. I don't know why I find that particular comment so funny.
I mean, the guy's got a jet.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I've been in jets. I know what they cost. It's really expensive, so we should stop doing that. Remarkably, Trump apparently failed to tell his partners in Seoul about the concession before offering it to Kim. Regarding President Trump's comment regarding ending the combined military drills, we need to find out the exact meaning or intention behind his comments at this point, a South Korean military official told NBC. Now, so, you know, that poses the question, if South Korea and other allies in the region and allies around the world had no idea that this was coming, and, you know, Trump just unilaterally onto himself decided, we're gonna make these major changes to how business is done in the region with no consultation. And look, I'm not making the case that he needs the permission of the South Koreans in order to decide what he's going to do with American military assets. He can do what he wants, right? He's the president of the United States. He's the commander in chief. If he wants to pull everybody home from South Korea, he can pull everybody home with notice or without notice. But as a matter of policy, as a matter of courtesy, as a matter of trying to maintain good relations with our allies, wouldn't you want to give them a heads up? Wouldn't you want to give them a text, a phone call, something to let them know this is coming, as opposed to them learning about it the same way we all did, which is a press conference?
How about forget our allies, our troops themselves?
Right, right.
Who are suddenly left sweeping the floor instead of having fun.
Yeah, so, you know, I've got a number of questions coming out of this deal, and we'll come back and continue with the Bloomberg report on this as well and your phone calls at 651-989-5855. What do you think of this deal that's been struck between President Trump and Kim Jong-un? And what do you think of the handling of the Trump administration's handling of the North Korean situation generally? And another question that I would like to have us consider is, what would everybody be saying if this exact same thing was happening under Barack Obama? Because I posit that for the most part, probably 80% of the reaction would be completely flipped. If Barack Obama sat down with Kim Jong-un and came out of the meeting saying, yeah, we're going to stop our war games with no meaningful assurance of anything from North Korea, I mean, I know what Sean Hannity would be saying over this very air. I know what, you know, Ben Shapiro would be saying about it. Probably the same thing he's saying about Trump. I haven't checked in with what Shapiro's commentary has been about this deal, but I can imagine what it would be. He would be consistent, but that would be the rarity. Most people, I think the script would flip depending upon who's doing this. The other questions I have is, what's the goal here? What's Trump's strategy? Is there some hidden agenda, some sort of benefit that's outside the scope of what can be obviously seen? And also, what does this indicate about Trump's overall foreign policy? In particular, how do you juxtapose this with pulling out of the Iran deal? Because it occurs to me, and again, maybe I'm just not smart enough, maybe I'm not well read enough, maybe I just don't understand what I'm talking about, maybe you can help me. 651-989-5855. But isn't this exactly the same, if not worse, than the Iran deal that Trump said was horrible and just pulled out of? There's no meaningful verification that North Korea is going to do anything whatsoever, and we're just giving up concessions. Explain this to me. Closing argument. My name is Walter Autzen. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. just over half of all Americans say they approve of how President Donald Trump has handled North Korea. But only a quarter think that his summit this week with Kim Jong-un will lead to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, according to a Reuters opinion poll released on Wednesday. That's something that I also don't understand. And they go into more detail breaking down this poll. Half the people approve of what Trump is doing, but like half of those people who approve of it actually think it's going to accomplish anything, which is bizarre. Like, I want to understand the Venn diagram crossover of the people who are like, I approve of what he's doing, but I don't think it's going to work.
I'm in that camp. Okay. Like, I think that it's a good move for Trump to be speaking with Kim Jong-un because, you know, I'm of the philosophy diplomacy with all.
Sure.
But I'm still skeptical of whether it's going to get anywhere. I mean, in contradiction to the Vice and Bloomberg articles, it is too soon to tell whether or not it will have a bad or good result, really. Mm-hmm. But I'm not that optimistic because it's politics, and Trump may not see his idea come to fruition due to the election, due to any number of electoral shifts, due to Congress, due to another big event happen in the world. Like,
right.
There are a lot of factors at play still that could keep this from becoming a success and North Korea actually becoming denuclearized. I mean, I don't think that the bigger issue with North Korea is just that it's a cult of personality that's killing its people.
Right.
Not that they have nuclear weapons. That's a side effect of their government, which is a necrocracy, which is like one of two in the world. And so I think the fact that they have nuclear weapons is a side effect of their larger backwardness.
Yeah. Which just got a degree of legitimacy in terms mm-hmm. of being. So, you know, what it all comes down to is there are competing worldviews and prescriptions for how foreign policy ought to work. And depending upon which of those ideas you subscribe to, different types of policy prescriptions are put forward. What I don't understand about what Trump is doing is that it seems as though, depending upon the day of the week or the country in question, he's operating from a totally different rule book. I mean, he's got John Bolton advising him, who I guarantee you is pulling his hair out as a result of what's going on right now with North Korea. Bolton is, there's no way he's on board with the way this thing is going down. And but he loves what Trump did with Iran. I mean, that's right out of the Bolton playbook. Cancel the deal, right? And so what's the overriding philosophy here? And I think the obvious answer is there is none. There is none. Which, to me, that's more concerning than the particulars of this deal or even the Iran deal, is a lack of a unified vision and a unified philosophy about what it is that we're trying to accomplish on the world stage. Let's talk to Eric in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program. Eric, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you?
Good.
Good. See, I wanted to make a quick comment. I was listening, and you kind of compared the Iran deal and the Korean deal, and
we're
kind of comparing the two of them. And, you know, I really don't think they're anything alike, because on the one hand, with the Iran deal, you have us paying that country however many billions or tens of billions of dollars in gold and cash and currency for what most people would consider kind of an average deal, with weak verifications on what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
On the North Korean Kim Jong-un meeting, there's really no risk in it for Trump because it doesn't matter. He gave up nothing. He gave up the war games, but you know, the cost on that is minimal. He could start him up again.
Yeah.
He didn't pay him any cash. He didn't concede anything. He didn't mm-hmm. say he was bringing any troops home. So mm-hmm. even if it goes south, there really, I don't see any downside in what he did. And I do think something will happen, not because of Trump, but I do think something will happen because of Kim Jong-un. I know he is hurting financially. The country is really hurting financially. I know mm-hmm. they were using or rumored to be using cryptocurrencies several months back. They may still be doing that, but most of those currencies have tanked in the last 6 months. So I know they're financially hurting. They have to do something. And I don't think there's any risk in it. I think until he actually gives up something significant, there's no risk for the U.S.
Fair enough. I can't take umbrage with any of those observations. Indeed, it jives with the way that Trump phrased things at his press conference, because what he said was, in so many words, this is a provocative action, having these war games. That's the intention, of course. Like, the intention of the war games is to put North Korea on notice.
Right.
And he's saying, while we're engaged in deal making, it doesn't make sense to also be pointing a gun at their head.
Yeah, that's true. And I think he could point the gun at their head, too, because I think they're running out of options. But I look at it as heads he wins, tails he doesn't lose. That's the way it's going to work. And the U.S. can call the shots on it. They're desperate. He said today that he thinks Kim Jong-un wants the deal more than he does. That's probably true.
Yeah.
I don't think Kim Jong-un particularly cares about freeing his country or anything like that. I just think it's about finances. It's just, that's what it's all about with him, and he's hurting.
Fair enough. Appreciate the analysis, Eric. Great contribution to the program. Yeah, I buy that. It makes a fair amount of sense. I guess where I get stuck, and the reason for my instinctual comparison between the Korean deal and the Iran deal, is that they both deals appear to be, or both actions by the Trump administration regarding each deal appear to be informed by opposing foreign policy orientations. You know, the pulling out of the Iran deal is a very hawkish, John Bolton-esque, you know, be tough on our enemies, don't negotiate with terrorists type of move. Whereas sitting down with Kim Jong-un and saying, we're not going to engage in war games with our South Korean allies, by the way, we're not even going to call them before we make this decision, we're just going to decide not to do it, seems like a very conciliatory, you know, almost Obama-esque, Pollyannish type move. So what's the philosophical consistency between the two?
Well, I mean, I think that we touched on it when the Iran deal was made by saying that Trump wanted to redo the Iran deal because he wants to put his name on it.
Hmm.
But I think it's also a larger viewpoint of what's been going on with the Trump administration the entire time he's been even running for president, in that he brings people on to do something for him temporarily and then kind of puts him in the back seat. Like John Bolton, Trump pulled out of the Iran deal right after John Bolton was appointed as his national security advisor. And
so he hires as a PR move, is what you're saying?
No, he hires him to help him pull out of the Iran deal.
I got
you. And then he takes a back seat.
I got you.
Because before that, H.R. McMaster was the national security advisor, and that was during the airstrikes in Syria. And H.R. McMaster was brought on to help guide those. And then he kind of took a back seat, and there was a lot of news articles about how H.R. McMaster and Trump don't get along anymore, and then he was out.
Yeah.
So I think it's just Trump brought Bolton on to do that, and now Trump is in charge again.
Huh. Your take, 651-989-5855, and we'll move on to some of the other news that's going on locally and around the country. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Ain't nothing going on but the bomb rap song, hitting all night long. Just like me on the black and white ivory, getting six on the T-Delete. You don't want to see a G-break.
There's an opportunity for somebody to do a short film about the conflict between Senator Rand Paul and his neighbor with this as the soundtrack. It would be awesome. It'd be fantastic. And we're going to get into the details that have emerged as to what that conflict was and what led to Rand Paul's neighbor tackling him and breaking his ribs. It's kind of hilarious. It's kind of hilarious. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream us. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. Let's get one more comment in on North Korea from Jeff in West St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Walter.
Yep.
I just wanted to say that, you know, we were worried about legitimizing Kim by having our president meet with him.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that when he has anywhere between 30 and 60 nuclear weapons, according to our defense intelligence, I think that makes him legitimate.
That's a fair point.
I think, you know, so I don't think it diminished our president any to meet with him. I think what I'd like to see the end game be here is that now that the window is open, and we don't know how long it'll be open, but I want our 7,500 soldiers back that we left there during the Korean conflict. That's a win right off the bat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
If he can do that, even if nothing gets done right away on the humanitarian crisis that's going on there, or the nuclear weapons, if he can bring the soldiers back, that's going to be huge.
Yeah, agreed.
Not just in the United States, but to the world. And I think he does have an end game, because I think he is trying to show North Korea that if they come into the civilized world, the things that can be...
Sure.
And I think when he brings that, you know, when Pompeo had that North Korean delegation in the United States here, he didn't bring them to Washington. He had them tour Manhattan.
Right.
To check out the skylines.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So
see what life could be like under a different way of living. Yeah.
Right. And at least we have a dialogue going. Now, it may not be fruitful, but it's better than having a nuclear tipped ICBM aimed at 30 of our cities.
Hey, I don't disagree with you. That's now, but of course the question becomes, is that actually the result, right? Like, is, because the history of these types of talks between North Korea and the United States, or North Korea and everybody or anybody, is that they say they're going to do things and then they don't.
Yep. So Trump suspended the war games with South Korea, and they that we gave up. That could be changed tomorrow.
Correct.
But we're going to find out real quick about how big of a deal it is to North Korea, because if we suspended them, if they're not going to follow through on their end, then you have that hammer to bring back.
Sure.
And it's the way the impression I was getting is that once we started down this road, there's no turning around and going back, because Trump has said he's not going to have a nuclearized North Korea. So one way or the other, and I'd rather have it this way than the other.
Yeah. Well, to give it, look, you're inferring a policy or a strategy that, to my mind, makes a lot of sense. I just don't know that that's actually the strategy. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not clear to me.
I'm not, here's where I'm at on that, Walter, is that I think Trump has some input, but I think that there's a lot of people in his cabinet or in his circle that they're very good at this. Mike Pompeo is a brilliant man. Okay. And some of the Secretary of Defense, Mattis. Okay. He's not a dummy either.
Right.
So I think a lot of this stuff is that, things that haven't been tried, you can't just write them out of hand saying that they won't work because they haven't been tried before. And it's how do you apply this?
Sure. Appreciate the call. Appreciate the insights, Jeff. The approach that Jeff articulates there to this problem is indicative of a foreign policy that I generally agree with. And if indeed that is what President Trump is basing his actions off of, then I applaud it. And it makes a lot of sense, because what Jeff's articulating there is the notion that ultimately, if we're actually going to influence, you know, everything that, say, George W. Bush and the neocons attempted to affect through force, you know, the spreading of democracy around the world, the building of nations and what have you. It doesn't actually happen by force. You can't put a gun to somebody's head and say, now be free. Gosh darn it. Like, it doesn't work that way. That's an oxymoron. People have to want it. They have to want to obtain the value that is made possible through the condition of liberty. And so if the objective here is show the North Koreans, particularly in their time of apparent fiscal desperation, what the possibilities are if they loosen the grip on their people a little bit, if they throttle down on the provocative aggression against their neighbors a little bit, look at what you could have. You could get a little taste of this international trade. You could get a little taste of the Manhattan skyline if you adopt different ways, if you give peace a chance, so to speak. If that's the strategy backed up with the ultimate threat of, if you go the other way, we're going to bring back more than war games, then I approve of it. The reason why I'm confused is because there's nothing to clearly indicate that that is, in fact, the strategy, number one. And number two, it doesn't seem consistent with other actions that this administration has taken, such as dropping the mother of all bombs on Syria or on Syria and the pulling out of the Iran deal and what have you. So we'll see. We'll see moving forward how things pan out. We'll continue to monitor it and continue to chat about it as new news emerges. So from Slate, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul was hospitalized in November with broken ribs and bruised lungs after his next door neighbor tackled him on his own lawn. The bizarre, extreme nature of the violence between the two older men in an affluent Kentucky suburb sparked immediate speculation. What could have caused this neighbor to become so blinded by rage? Now, as the neighbor, retired anesthesiologist Renee Booker, has admitted guilt and is requesting a sentence of probation instead of prison time, more details have emerged about their feud. In a 10-page memorandum filed Friday and obtained by the Bowling Green Daily News, Booker's attorney argued that the prosecution's request of 21 months in prison was too severe given Booker's reputation as a pillar of his community and the isolated nature of the offense. The memorandum describes in a simmering anger that started in the summer of 2017 and that, as has been previously reported, dealt with a minor lawn dispute over the pruning of some trees. In the fall, that now simmering anger grew hotter. In September, Paul piled limbs and trimmings from shrubs in a 5-foot-high and 10-foot-long pile near the property line between them. Brooker, who called the pile unsightly after several weeks, moved the debris into portable dumpsters and had them taken away. In October, Paul reconstructed the pile. A few days later, Booker again had them hauled away. Less than 10 days later, Paul again made another pile of limbs and leaves, again in the same spot. Booker took his beef to the River Green Homeowners Association, but it did not help. On November 2nd, Booker hit some kind of limit with his patience. He poured gasoline on the pile of debris and set it on fire. The resulting fireball gave him second-degree burns on his arms, neck, and face. The next day, Paul, possibly underestimating the depths of his neighbor's rage, used his lawnmower to blow leaves from his property onto Booker's. Then he piled on the insults. During this process, Rand Paul stepped away from his lawnmower, gathered several more branches from the adjacent pile of trash, and placed them in the exact location where the last pile had been burned just one day prior. That is when Booker full-body tackled Paul. Booker, according to his account, told Paul afterward that he wanted this to stop. Paul replied that Booker would be getting a visit from the police, and Booker will be sentenced on Friday. So there you go. There's the details of the dispute between neighbors that culminated in a full-body tackle of Rand Paul after his neighbor set himself on fire, apparently. And look, there's definitely fault on both sides of this. There's no doubt. There was provocation on the senator's part, obviously. That said, one man crossed property lines and the other one didn't. One man thought that he was going to resolve the situation by lighting a fire, committing arson on his neighbor's yard. right? So overall, all things considered, the guy who is in the wrong here is this Booker fella who is going to be sentenced as a result of assaulting the senator. That said, there was a really easy solution to this from day one. Real simple and obvious. Offense. Build a fence. You know, that old phrase about well-mended fences, it's a phrase for a reason. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson, 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. You know, when I was a kid, I had a sense that we lived in a post-racial world. And that's saying something for a guy like me, who was the son of a black father and a white mother. You know, race was an ever-present influence upon my day-to-day life. And you know, when I phrase it like that, it sounds like, oh, you know, I woke up and I thought about race, and I went to school and I thought about race. But the opposite was true, right? Like, it was there. It's something that I had to be conscious of, but it really didn't matter. It honestly didn't. And as I recall, it wasn't something that was part of the conversation. It wasn't part of the conversation with the people that I knew, with the people that I hung out with, in the world around me. There was a more harmonious tone racially, which, you know, is saying something coming out of the turbulent 70s into the 80s and through the 90s. Today, it's different. Today, race is a touch point that sets off divisive emotions and triggers people to bubble forth with hidden rage. And it's pretty sad. It's pretty ridiculous. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. A couple of race-related stories here for you, both from the Star Tribune. A Republican lawmaker is being criticized for saying there aren't enough white kids to go around when discussing integration in schools at an event in northern Arizona. Representative David Stringer, a Republican for Prescott, spoke Monday at the Yavapai County Republican Men's Forum. His speech was live-streamed on Facebook and saved to his campaign page. It was later removed. But a clip widely circulated on social media by a Democrat showed Stringer talking about how immigration is changing the demographic makeup of the country. 60% of public school children in the state of Arizona today are minorities, he said. That complicates racial integration because there aren't enough white kids to go around, Stringer said in part of the video. The clip also shows Stringer saying immigration is politically destabilizing and immigration today represents an existential threat to the United States. Now, I just want to pause on a moment because it seems as though the comment that is the source of controversy here by Stringer is saying that there aren't enough white kids to go around in a context where 60% of students in Arizona schools are minorities. Now, I fail to see, and I guess I need a lefty to call in and explain this to me. I fail to see what's provocative or controversial or shocking about that statement. Because what he's speaking to, at least as far as I can tell, is he's accepting their premise, right? Like, he's saying if the point is we need to have integrated schools, if the point is we need to stop having a scenario where the people of color are over here and the white people are over here, then out of mathematical necessity, you have to have enough white people to make the schools integrated. And when the ratio is 60-40 of white to non-white, mathematically that can't happen. Where's the controversy here? I don't quite understand it.
Well, it would have been a lot more controversial had he said it the other way, like if he would have said there's not enough black kids to go around.
Right.
Like that would have been controversial.
Yeah, but well, and I don't know, even then, if his point is, look, and granted, you're reading things, either way you try to interpret this, you're reading things into it.
I mean, it's an ineloquent statement.
Absolutely.
At best.
At best, right? Like, that's, it's, but in order to make it at its worst, you have to impose something upon it that's not actually there.
Yeah, I mean, if he would have said we can't accomplish integration because there's not enough black kids to go around, like that's bad.
I mean, the premise of the statement is that integration is a desirable outcome.
Right.
So how can you argue with that?
I don't know.
If you're a lefty,
they didn't,
at any rate.
They didn't like how he said it, I guess.
I guess. Let's talk to Craig in Plymouth. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, Walter, thank you. This goes back to the Korean deal, which is not a deal yet, number one.
Okay.
We don't know if it's going to be, we don't know if it's going to be a treaty, or it's going to be Trump's decision.
Well, I mean, Donald Trump seems to know something solid because he just declared North Korea no longer a nuclear threat.
That's fine. You know, for public consumption, that's good, but that'll come out over time.
Okay.
But I think the main difference between this and the Iran, supposedly the Iran deal,
mm-hmm.
Now there was supposedly, what I read, there was a letter from the State Department that saying that whole operation was actually a statement of intentions. It wasn't a treaty. It wasn't an executive decision made just by President Obama. Plus, and I think the other countries involved were Germany, France, and them.
You're talking about Iran now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, you've got Iran there. The countries that are supposedly signing this deal are 1,000 miles away. What you have here, this whole thing started when Kim Jong-il stepped across the DMZ border to meet.
All right. Unfortunately, we're flat out of time, Craig. I wish we could hear the rest of your analysis. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Of the program are well aware of my, shall we say, skeptical stance towards the presidency of Donald Trump. And, you know, it's not personal. It's not. And listen, I know it's difficult in this climate to approach the topic of the president and the president's effect upon the Republican Party and his effect upon conservatism with anything resembling nuance. It's difficult because the left doesn't really offer us a whole lot of choices, right? You know, the status of the conversation, the status of the rhetoric is such that you're forced into a binary choice. You're forced into either being pro-Trump or anti-Trump, right? Like, there's no room for, well, I mean, you know, I've got some issues with the guy, but I like some of the things he's done, and, you know, I wish we could tweak this here and dial back that there and have more of this thing. That's great. Like, there's no room for that. There's no room for shopping a la carte. You have to either be on board the train or part of the resistance. These are your two options. And I fundamentally reject both those options. For reasons that I would like to think are pretty self-evident. It's, frankly, it's stupid to subscribe to such binary thinking regarding something as important as the overall direction of public policy at the federal level. It's a little bit more important than the partisan bickering would lead us to believe. And yet, you know, there is a real effect that the status quo has upon the ability of conservatives and conservatism to advance going forward. And I think one of the indicators of that in the news as of late is the downfall of South Carolina Republican Mark Sanford. This is a guy who, by all accounts, is the real deal when it comes to small government, Tea Party, fiscally responsible conservatism. This is a guy who vetoed bills from a legislator or a legislature led by his own party, right? because he didn't feel like those bills were conservative enough, responsible enough, in line with principles. And he was applauded for it. You know, this is a guy who stood up, stood tall against Barack Obama, was regarded as a pillar of the Tea Party movement when it was at its peak, and he was just voted out in a primary. Why? Because he's not on board 100% with the president of the United States. It's about a man. It's about a person. Not principles. Not, you know, how often have we heard it said or said ourselves, you know, if these guys would just vote the right way, you know, we should vote them out because of the way that they're voting on these bills, because of the actions that they're taking in office. Yeah. Well, here's a guy who's taken all the right actions, according to the playbook that's been offered by grassroots activists. Here's a guy who is making all the right moves, saying all the right things, but he took the wrong position on a guy. And so he's got to go. Is this really what it's come to? I mean, the answer is obviously yes. This is what it's come to. But what are the consequences of that? Where do we go? Where does conservatism go from here when it's become divorced from principle, divorced from ideas, and defined by whatever a guy at the top says? Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream us. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. 651-989-5855 for your thoughts. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. From CNN Politics. South Carolina Republican Mark Sanford said in an interview Wednesday after his primary loss that he's not upset with President Donald Trump for tweeting support of his opponent a few hours before polls closed. I wouldn't say it made my day, and it's not what anybody would yearn for in the world of politics, but it is what it is, Sanford told a small group of reporters in the Capitol. Reflecting the day after his loss, Sanford acknowledged that his election had become a referendum on if he was supportive enough of the president, who he has outspokenly criticized at times. That's ultimately what the race devolved down to, which was I Trump enough or not, Sanford said. On Wednesday night, in an interview with CNN's Anderson Cooper, Sanford said he thinks it's important to have vigorous dissent among the branches of government and within the Republican Party. It is okay to disagree, Sanford said on Anderson Cooper 360. What's interesting is my voting record has been 89% with the president, and therefore to send a tweet out to say not supportive, A, not true, but B, goes to this larger question of do we want to have a litmus test or do we want to have folks who will agree with us 80 to 90% of the time and say you're on the team, he continued. But earlier on Wednesday, he also said he hopes that his loss won't have a chilling effect on fellow Republicans, saying vigorous dissent is the hallmark of democracy and a sign of health in our political system. Well, let me be the first one to tell you, it does have a chilling effect. And that, it had a chilling effect before this loss. This loss just cements the chilling effect. I can't tell you the number of people. I wish I could. I really do. I wish I could tell you the specifics, give you the names, give you the accounts of the conversations I had with people during the 2016 election. Prominent people within the Republican Party. Names you would recognize. Who were terrified at the prospect of Donald Trump getting the nomination. And once he got the nomination, terrified of the prospect of him winning because of the effect it would have upon the Republican Party and upon the conservative movement. Today, they're all waving the flag. They're all wearing the red hat. They're all talking about how great he is. Right? Why? Because they actually think that? No, they don't. They're saying it because they have to in order to survive politically.
I mean, it's going to be interesting in Minnesota because I think that one issue where Jeff Johnson could get stuck, or any Republican candidate, Pawlenty could just as easily win the nomination. But I think one issue in which the Republican candidate will get stuck on is protecting farmers from Trump's tariffs. Because, well, farmers are obviously a group that any gubernatorial candidate wants to play towards, and they could do so by attempting to mitigate the effects of tariffs on farmers at the state level. They could also be seen as going against Trump,
right,
as a Republican voter, or two Republican voters.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's an odd predicament, and it's a predicament that never would have manifest before. There never would have been that conflict under pretty much anybody else. I mean, I don't know any other Republican president who was looking for tariffs. Be that as it may, you know, switching back the focus here to Mark Sanford, here's a little breakdown from Politico of who this guy is and what his resume is. They describe his resume as beyond reproach to those on the right. He was D.C.'s dashing fiscal hawk during his first stint in the House. And then, after term limiting himself and returning home to South Carolina, he won the governorship, vetoed hundreds of measures from his Republican-led legislature, and gained fame by refusing to accept President Barack Obama's stimulus funding in 2009. His political instincts are razor sharp. Sanford had never lost a campaign. And this was written last year, which joined with his ideological mooring. Once he made a conservative favorite for the presidency as a result of his electoral success. He had personal failings, namely an infamous 2009 affair with Argentinian television journalist Maria Shapur, and appears to have been forgiven by the people of South Carolina's 1st Congressional District, who sent him back to Congress in a 2013 special election before reelecting him in 2014 and 2016. All this gives Sanford a unique sense of liberation to speak his mind about a president whose substance and style he considers a danger to democracy. Now, again, this was written in 2017, and the calculation that Mark Sanford made was, look at what I've done. I have bona fides, right? Like, I've actually walked the walk that all these other candidates, all these other Republicans, all these other conservatives just talk. I've actually done it, and people know I've done it, and they are so supportive of me because I've done it that I've been kicked around for president of the United States. I've been sent back to Congress after having already been there once. I've been the governor of a state. I've got all this political cachet, all this political capital. So I'm going to push all that to the middle on the bet that that leverage gives me credibility to criticize the Republican president of the United States where I disagree with him. He lost that bet. This is what Corey Whalen, who is the, I believe she remains the communications director for Congressman Justin Amash, she posted this to Facebook today regarding Mark Sanford. She said, "I don't want to draw too many sweeping conclusions because of his primary race. It was so close, and there's always low turnout affairs for a primary race. But the loss of Mark Sanford, one of the most consistently principled and libertarian-leaning members of Congress, hurts. Mark was Tea Party in the original sense of the movement's coalescence around fiscal conservatism before the Tea Party existed. He's a thoughtful policy wonk whose quest to eliminate our unsustainable $21 trillion national debt reflected a career-long fixation on what many of us, perhaps falsely, considered a core tenet of conservatism, small government. Replacing Mark with a candidate who, by all appearances, is more like Lindsey Graham than she is like him, is a serious blow to liberty. Pretending otherwise is nonsensical, populist, bloviating, notwithstanding. I'll certainly miss Mark, one of our stalwart Liberty and Freedom Caucus guys, and the nation, whether people realize it or not, has suffered a great loss, too." And, you know, there you go. And, look, let me end on a positive note with this segment, because up till now, it certainly hasn't been one. You know, we talked about optimism on Monday, and the importance of having a positive outlook about the future. And that's something that I'm trying to take to heart and to apply and to practice what I preach on that front. I don't believe that those Tea Party values, that those liberty values that Mark Sanford stood for and that I stand for and that a lot of you stood alongside me fighting for during the Tea Party years, I don't believe those values are dead. I don't believe they're gone. We're going through, the Republican Party and the conservative movement is going through a turbulent time where we don't know, we're having an identity crisis, yeah, of sorts. And I don't know what the short to midterm consequences or manifestations of that crisis are going to be. But I know this: liberty is morally correct. liberty is the only path toward achieving happiness. And the substance of the American culture acknowledges this. The fact that we get up every morning and we go to work and we put our nose to the grindstone and we send our kids to school and we involve them in activities that are structured to teach them the importance of teamwork and responsibility and accountability and ownership and inspiration, and that we drive them toward a vision of their own future that is positive and full of hope. That tells me that deep down inside, these values, these principles continue to thump within the heart of our nation. And so it will rise again. Liberty will rise again. It will become dominant. What's happening right now, in my view, is that conservatives and Republicans under the Trump years were so abused, were so badgered by the left. You know, everything's racist, everything's sexist, everything makes you a horrible Nazi. And this was coupled with seeing loss after loss, right? The passage of Obamacare, the reelection of Barack Obama, the upholding of Obamacare through the Supreme Court, the institution of gay marriage nationally through the Supreme Court. You know, all these blows that conservatives took one after the other, after the other, after the other, all the while being called horrible names and being, you know, described as un-American, anti-American, that there just got to be a point, just like there is when somebody's provoking you, you know, into a bar fight. There's always that point at which it stops being a conversation and it becomes a brawl. And we've reached that point. Republicans are now in a brawl. And it's, you know, somebody's going to end up on the floor and somebody's going to walk away victorious. And that's what Trump is. Trump is the guy who is to lead us during the brawl to victory. And on some level, I understand that. On some level, that makes a large deal of emotional sense. My hope and my expectation is that once the brawl is over, once we get it out of our system, we're going to rediscover why it is that we're involved in the fight in the first place. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. All right. Now we can rag on something that we all agree on here. Apparently, a communications aide for Keith Ellison, who, of course, is seeking to be the next attorney general here in the state of Minnesota. Apparently, this communications aide by the name of Dan Riefel has called for the death of Jeff Bezos. This brought to our attention by Abdi Muhammad, caller into the program, friend of the show. He's been a guest on the show in studio. Pro-Trump Muslim. That's his claim to fame. And this is the tweets from this guy, Dan Riefel, calls for a guillotine to be used against Jeff Bezos, who is the CEO of Amazon. And the question Abdi asks on Twitter is this rhetoric invited by the DFL's frontrunner to be Attorney General of Minnesota? Low standards all around. Now, what I find even more troubling, right? Because here's the thing. Calling for the guillotine for Jeff Bezos, that's not something that's ever actually going to happen, right? Like the idea that we're going to march the rich, we're going to march the CEOs, you know, off to their execution in the ultimate act of Bernie Sanders revolution, is something that's so absurd that you can't even really take it seriously. Granted, the statement is still, of course, inappropriate. But what gets me more about this guy, Dan Riefel, is that his title on Twitter, like what he has his name show up as on Twitter, is this statement. Tax income over $5 million at 99%. Now, that's not an exaggeration. That's not like the rhetoric about the guillotine for Jeff Bezos, he can make the fair claim that he's being theatrical when he says that, that he's not actually calling for the death of Jeff Bezos. But when he puts tax income at $5 million or over $5 million at 99%, that's something he actually believes. That's something he's actually advocating for. And a candidate for attorney general here in this state, Keith Ellison, has him working for him. Now, yeah, I did the math during the break. What this would mean if this became policy is that making $5 million, earning $5 million, putting $5 million worth of value into the economy, which let's just back up a little bit. If you earn $5 million, the truth of the matter is you actually put substantially more value into the economy than the $5 million you earned. Because how is it that you earned it in the first place? How does trade work? For any trade to be consented to by the two people involved in it, both parties have to believe that they are walking away better off than they were before. So every time you earn a dollar, the person who's giving it to you, your employer, the person you're selling something to, the person you're providing a product or service for, every time you earn a dollar, that person believes that they've obtained something that's worth more than the dollar they gave to you. So you're creating, you are always in a free society, and to the extent that the society is free, creating more value than you see on your paycheck. That's true of everyone. And so the person who's making $5 million is contributing substantially more than that in terms of value to the economy. Under this concept, this plan by Dan Riefel, communications aide to Keith Ellison, a person who contributed over $5 million of value to the economy would take home $50,000.
What it means is no one would make over $4.9 million.
Well, that's right. Now, no doubt this is part of a broader, like, I highly doubt that it would be, hey, you get to keep all your money until you hit $5 million, and then we're going to take 99% of it. But however this breaks down, the effect is that there's going to be less productivity in the economy, right? Which means, you know, if people don't get to keep what they earn, they're not going to produce the value in the first place. Hello, Venezuela. Like, this isn't theoretical. We can see it in the real world in action. And yet, this is the kind of thing that continues to be prescribed for by people. I mean, look, Keith Ellison is the mainstream of the Democratic Party. He is a darling. He's the deputy chair of the Democratic National Committee. He's a congressman from Minnesota representing the 5th District. This guy is not outside of the mainstream of the Democrats. And this is what they consider to be acceptable rhetoric, acceptable positions to take, acceptable ways to express yourself in public.
It reminds me of that tweet that Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, sent out during the campaign where she said, well, it's true that we're all shocked by what Trump is saying. We've seen the Clinton campaign actually doing them.
Right.
And that's what we see here. Like, yeah, what some people say is pretty shocking, but what people, I mean, this guy said something, but he's actively involved in the system now.
Yeah.
And working towards taking away your money.
Right. Yeah, and to me, that's more concerning than the comment about, you know, the guillotine for Jeff Bezos, because first of all, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt that that's a theatrical hyperbole, number one. Doesn't make it appropriate. Doesn't make it right. It's not an excuse. But I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt that he doesn't actually plan to murder Jeff Bezos. But he does actually plan to take 99% of some people's money.
How do you take 99% of somebody's money?
At the point of a gun. Right.
Death.
Yeah, well, that's just it. Yeah. And look, those two statements are philosophically consistent. On the one hand, saying, I want to kill you. And on the other hand, saying, I want to take 99% of your stuff. That's philosophically consistent, because to take someone's property by force is it's a form of life depletion. Property is the frozen form of your life. How do you get your property? By expending your life. Right? You only have so much time. Your heart only beats so many times. You only get to be on this earth for so long. And it takes some amount of your life in order to earn your property. And so when somebody comes along and they take it, they are taking that part of your life from you. They are making you, to a precise degree, a slave. And that's what this guy believes in. That's what the entire Democratic Party believes in. And again, I marvel at the fact that they somehow continue to prevail in the public discourse on so many fronts. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Edson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Are we here to serve the planet, or is the planet here to serve us? That's a question that I think we need to consider before we decide whether or not we ought to freak out about certain headlines. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. And on your iHeartRadio app, we're here 9 to 11 weeknights. You can catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in that iHeartRadio app, and our channel will pop up for you. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Omlin takes those calls and produces the show. From the Star Tribune, the melting of Antarctica is accelerating at an alarming rate, with about 3 trillion tons of ice disappearing since 1992, an international team of ice experts said in a new study. In the last quarter century, the southernmost continent's ice sheet, a key indicator of climate change, melted into enough water to cover Texas to a depth of nearly 13 feet, scientists calculated. All that water made global oceans rise about 0.3 inches. From 1992 to 2011, Antarctica lost nearly 84 billion tons of ice a year. From 2012 to 2017, the melt rate increased to more than 241 billion tons a year, according to the study Wednesday in the journal Nature. I think we should be worried. That doesn't mean we should be desperate, said University of California Irvine's Elizabella Valenconga, one of 88 co-authors. Things are happening. They are happening faster than we expected. Part of Western Antarctica, where most of the melting occurred, is in a state of collapse, said co-author Ian Jungen of the University of Washington. The study is the second of assessments planned every several years by a team of scientists working with NASA and the European Space Agency. Their mission is to produce the most comprehensive look at what's happening to the world's vulnerable ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland. Outside experts praise the work as authoritative. Unlike single measurement studies, this team looks at ice loss in 24 different ways, using 10 to 15 satellites, as well as ground and air measurements and computer simulations, said lead author Andrew Shepherd of the University of Leeds in England. So the question becomes, what are the implications of this? Now, let's, for the sake of argument, let's not question the veracity of the study. Let's assume that it's correct. Let's assume that the ice caps are, in fact, melting, that the sea levels are rising, and that it's only a matter of time before Al Gore's, you know, worst depiction of a post-apocalyptic Mad Max, you know, day after tomorrow climate catastrophe occurs. Okay, maybe won't take the presumption that far. Let's just presume for the time being that the ice caps are in fact melting. What are we supposed to do about that? Because obviously the implication that we're meant to take, or the inference that we're meant to take from this, is that climate change is happening. It's anthropogenic. It's caused by mankind. It presents a threat to the earth. And so something must be done in order to stop it. But what must be done? And what is the effect of that going to be? Here's my fundamental problem with the environmental movement. Is that, you know, like so much that's born from the left, they look only at one side of the equation. And the side that they look at is, you know, the environmental impact. But the question they don't ask is, whose environment? Whose environment? in the environment as a concept, the environment is a context for something else. I mean, the very word environment implies something within it. So what within the environment are we actually concerned about? Let me tell you what I'm concerned about. Human life. Human survival. Human thriving. I'm concerned about human civilization, the advancement and sustenance of mankind. That's my concern. And when I think about the environment, I think about it in that context, or I think about it as a context for that. And so I'm concerned about the environment to the degree and for the purpose of it sustaining human life. And so when your prescription for solving the thawing of the ice is cutting back on the means of human survival and thriving, then the prescription becomes worse than the problem. The prescription becomes worse than the illness. It's like saying, oh, you got cancer. Here's a gun with a bullet in it. It's loaded. Point at your head and pull the trigger. Right? Like that, that'll stop the cancer. Well, that's a true statement. It will. But it kind of circumnavigates the whole point, which is that you're trying to sustain and prolong your life. And this is a side of the equation that the environmental folks don't seem to be interested in acknowledging or talking about. And to the degree that they are, many of them who, because they broadly fall into two different categories. There's the folks who just evade this concept entirely. You know, they talk about the environment completely divorced from any consideration of human quality of life. And they just refuse to address it. And then there's another camp of people who are very much aware of the fact that environment requires the identification of who the environment is for. And what they've decided is that the environment is for things other than us. The environment is for the animals. The environment is for the biodiversity of the species. The environment is for its own sake, that the planet Earth exists for its own sake, for itself, that it is the beginning and the end, and that we are only an inconsequential part of it that ought to step aside and let ourselves die, if necessary, in order to protect the planet. And, you know, I love it when they're honest about that, when they're upfront. You know, we had a story in the stack somewhere in the past couple of weeks of a gal in England, I believe it was. She's 30-something. She's in her early 30s. She has a husband who wants to have a child, but she's made the decision that she's not going to have one. She's not going to procreate. And her rationale is there's too many people on the earth. Overpopulation is a problem. It's destroying the environment. And in order to do her part to reduce her carbon footprint, she's not going to have a child.
I mean, it's probably good that she doesn't.
Well, okay, fair. But for reasons other than the one she's citing, right? Like, we don't want to propagate more stupid. But, you know, setting that aside, the idea that for the sake of the environment, I'm not going to live, or I'm going to restrict the degree to which I live, it's metaphorically, it is putting the cart before the horse, because living is the point. Living, like, there's no point in preserving the earth for no one, right? Like, we're going to preserve the earth just to have an earth, whether humans live on it or not. Like, to the degree the earth had, like, where are the activists who are concerned about Mars, right? Keeping Mars the way it is right now, making sure it never changes. The activists who are all concerned about the warming on Venus, right? Like, there are people concerned and activated about other planets because those planets don't have anybody on them. And we ought to take a clue from that, that the whole point of finding a sustainable way of life, to the degree that's even a thing worth pursuing, it's worth pursuing because of human beings. Human beings are the point. There's another piece here from the Star Tribune. I'll just give you the headline because it's sufficient. Aggressive doe remains on the loose in Shoreview after fatally stomping poodle.
The poodle had it coming.
It's another scene cut from the editing room floor of Napoleon Dynamite. A doe trampling a poodle. Now, that headline and this story, you know, silly as it may be, this presumes that human beings have some sort of dominion over nature, that human beings get to decide what constitutes a problem in the animal kingdom. You know, why is it that certain animals are considered pests and that we have no problem controlling where they roam and how they propagate, right? You know, we got to pick our worldview. Either we believe that we're in charge, either we believe that we are the point, either we believe that God gave us this earth in order to service us and our survival and our thriving, or we subscribe to the notion that the planet has its own inherent value and that we're just bugs on it that don't really matter. And, you know, we got to pick one. We can't have both. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So in the category of really obvious and incredibly predictable, we have a story out of the Star Tribune of a nonprofit in Minneapolis whose mission was to promote tourism in the city that was apparently taking taxpayers in that town for a ride. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. The nonprofit charged with drawing tourism, conventions, and national events like the X Games to Minneapolis overstated its success by nearly $200 million over the past 3 years. Meet Minneapolis gave flawed estimates by double-counting money generated by events, relying on pre-event estimates instead of readily available final counts, and in at least one case, ignoring a contractual mandate to procure an independent audit, according to a city audit presented Monday. Now, okay, so you have all that, right? The audit by the city finds all this stuff about this nonprofit called Meet Minneapolis. Again, that they double counted money generated by events, right? Which, who is their accountant? Are you kidding me? Like, they double counted money apparently multiple times, generated by events, plural, relied on pre-event estimates instead of readily available final counts. Like, who counts what? So I assumed we were going to clear out our inventory, but then we only sold 10% of it. But I'm going to report that we cleared it out. Like, what? And this is not something that happens by accident, these types of errors. And here's what the city council member who was in charge of the audit committee had to say about the whole thing. I just think this was sloppy work by Meet Minneapolis. Sloppy work.
It's called, they had an incentive to lie.
That's right. The gal's name in question was Lena Palmisano. That's the council member who had that stupid comment. She went on to say that the city relies on these numbers to decide how to invest in the city, including the $140 million Target Center renovation. The city budget includes about $10 million per year for the group, Meet Minneapolis, the bulk of that organization's annual budget. Our contract with them is predicated on performance metrics, she said, so we rely on accurate performance metrics to know if our city investments are paying off and by how much. We need to know we can trust their reports. The audit also found the city failed to properly verify that Meet Minneapolis was complying with its contract obligations and that it relied on verbal progress reports in lieu of documentation. You know what the worst part of this is? Nobody's going to face any consequences for it whatsoever.
Probably not. I mean, at least when the Met Council got exposed for their shenanigans at U.S. Bank Stadium, something changed. But this is not even a government organization.
Yeah.
And it like, I'm a big sports fan, but I care a lot about like politics too and transparency in government.
Mm-hmm.
And this just puts me at the, you know, it strikes both passions, really.
Right.
Because I, as much as I want sports in this town, as much as I like big events, well, I'm rethinking that big events thing after the Super Bowl and stuff like this, but like, we get beat over the head with $500 million packages for U.S. Bank Stadium, $150 million for the Target Center, $200 million for Target Field. Like, when is enough going to be enough? When are we going to say no? And I mean, like I said, I like sports and I hope that they continue in Minneapolis, but when are people going to say, okay, we have to stop? Like, this obviously provides value, but how much? What is the number that people will stop and say no?
Well, and I politically, I don't know the answer to that question because I would have thought it had been long before now, but apparently not. But morally, look, an organization like Minneapolis, a nonprofit that receives grants from the city in order to promote tourism, should not exist. There is no moral justification for the existence of that organization. If there is, in fact, value in advertising the city as being a great place for people to come and visit, then it should be quite easy to put together a for-profit organization or an organization that's funded by companies that do business here to take action towards that end.
Well, I think it just exposes the fact that these big events do nothing but benefit super rich people.
That's right.
It's just a chance for super rich people to be seen and flaunt their stuff. It doesn't help. It doesn't help you. It doesn't help me. It's an inconvenience to us at best.
Anytime somebody tries to make the argument that we need to put forward a bunch of tax dollars in order to obtain an economic value is lying on at face value. They're lying. Because that is impossible. It's impossible that the creation of value requires coercion. It's impossible that the creation of value requires you taking a gun and pointing at somebody's head and taking their money from them by force. And that's what we're talking about here. When we're talking about funding stadiums, when we're talking about handing over money to nonprofits that go on to you know, pay their executives very well and deliver nothing in terms of what they promised.
Commit fraud.
Yeah, commit fraud. We're talking about a destructive economic action. Earlier in the program, we talked about how the fact that, you know, so there's a Democrat working for Ellison as a staffer who wants to tax people who make over $5 million at 99%. The people who are actually making $5 million a year are producing more than that in terms of economic value. And when you operate in a condition of freedom, you have to provide something that's higher than the value you're receiving in trade. The only reason why you have to compel somebody at the point of a gun to pay for your stadium or pay for your advertising for your city or whatever the case may be, the only reason you have to force it is because it's not actually worth it. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.